Produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Joseph Cottrell, and Ken Fuller, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 604. Yes, best of the 80s.
Hi, this is Trevor Rabin, and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
Welcome to episode 604 of the Yes Music Podcast, Two Fans Exploration of the World's Greatest Progressive Rock Band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along in a few minutes' time. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. We took a break from Tales from Topographic Oceans this week to consider what Yes were up to in the 1980s. Across just four albums, if you're happy to call ABWH a Yes album, Yes music was somewhat different to what had come before. You're probably aware that our friends and YMP patrons Stephen Lamb and Dave Watkinson wrote a whole book about Yes in the 1980s, so don't forget to check that out if you don't already have a copy. It's currently available for a reduced price at Burning Shed. Mark and I chose our favourite songs from each of these four albums and consider what makes the Yes music of the 1980s great. Around the socials this week, beginning with the YMP discussion group on Facebook, Jeffrey Mason's list consisted of Rick Wakeman's new Prog Years box set, Ultimate Classic Rock talking to Steve Howe about the current live set list, a review with photos of Yes at Brown County Music Centre last week, a handful of reviews of the Yes album from the time of its release, a clipping of a 1966 The Sin concert, and a John Anderson interview from 1973. Doug Curran added the following: the painting of John Anderson and Ian Anderson, which I remember from the cover of Prog magazine, the fourth anniversary of From a Page, a great photo of Rick Wakeman, Alice Cooper, Brian May and Steve Hogarth, news of the forthcoming Bill Bruford fan convention in Tokyo, and the sticker set that comes with the Gottlieb Brothers' current tour book, based on the Tales tour book stickers. Stephen Lamb appeared on the Yes Shift podcast this week, and Joseph Cottrell was very positive about his trip to see Yes in Utah. Miguel Falcao has done it again. This time it's a bass cover of Circus of Heaven, and it's fabulous. And Hector Salvador Plaza added a great photo of the Peter Banks original Yes lineup. Over on X.com, there were, as always, too many things to mention individually, but Henry Potts posted about the Days Between Stations album Giants, produced, co-written and co-performed by Billy Sherwood, and Stephen Wilson's new spatial audio mix of the Yes album is being premiered in London next week, so get along to that if you can. Here's an audio comment from Robert Naser.
Hello, YMP. Robert Naser from Detroit, Michigan, checking in. You know, a month or so ago, I took a self-imposed hiatus in listening to the Yes Music podcast, as well as Dan and Stephen Schindler's Yes Shift, to avoid spoilers until the Yes appearance this month at the Andiamo Celebrity Showroom in Warren, just outside Detroit, Michigan. Now, regarding the concert, with front row, or rather with this particular venue, front dinner table seats right in front of Billy Sherwood, I couldn't be more pleased with the band's performance. A bit of a spoiler alert, since the recent set list of discussions, all connected, remains off the list, but Starship Trooper has joined Roundabout for the encore. And I'm glad I caught them before Steve's recent mishap with Cut to a Finger, which caused a couple shows to be canceled. My sympathies to Steve and to all of you whose appearances were canceled. Well, now that I've caught up with the Yes Music podcast, through the most recent episode, 602, let me say massive honors to the YMP for reaching 600-plus episodes. The Trevor Rabin appearance was outstanding and a well-deserved way to celebrate your accomplishment. I've enjoyed all the recent episodes. My gosh, 600 shows, no slacking. It just keeps getting better. Now, like John Holden did in the YMP comments for episode 601 on Steve Howe's guitars on Tales from Topographic Oceans, in which point you said no one plays guitar solos on electric 12-string guitars. Well, I've got to point out that while 12-string electric guitar solos may be rare, Steve Howe is just the guy to go there. The first half of Awaken is just electric 12-string, arguably even more frenetic and magnificent than the Telecaster work in the second half of the song. Now, for the guitar fanatics out there, a bit of trivia. While Awaken's first half, including those ripping solos, was originally played on a 12-string Rickenbacker, Steve currently plays an electric Steinberger 12-string for the tune live, And that specific guitar was built by Steinberger's then head technician, Jeff Babbitts, in Newburgh, New York. Jeff Babbitts, famously now of Babbitts Guitars. You may have seen those Babbitts acoustics with the bridge pins fantastically spread out across the lower bout. Okay, meanwhile, with the Peter DeMore and Brian Chatton and Trevor Rabin and Jeff Cummins interviews that did not disappoint. So many stories and insights, and I could not be more grateful to those excellent guests and to our hosts, Kevin and Mark. You guys are the best. Thank you once again for everything that you do.
Many thanks for that helpful and interesting comment, Robert. And many thanks to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week, including those who commented on last week's show notes. Doug Curran, Brian Breen, Jeremy North, Jeffrey Griselius, Margaret Evans, and Ray Reithmeyer.
Yes Music Podcast, 12 True Summers.
We are taking a bit of a break from our Tales focus this week, but Mark is with me as usual. Hello, Mark.
Greetings, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. What about you?
Well, it's been an interesting week, to say the least. Actually, the last couple of hours, 24 hours or so, have been interesting. I have been hacked. My Facebook has been. And while I've gotten my Facebook back again, I have lost my Messenger use from there. For some reason, it doesn't recognize anything that I have as far as a password in there. So for people who are using Messenger to get a hold of me, for example, I know our good friend and listener of the show, John D., has been contacting me frequently and is probably wondering why I haven't been responding to him. Well, it's because my Messenger is no longer working. So if you have an Instagram account, I am on Instagram as well, and it'd be easy to get a hold of me that way. If not, then just message me on my email, and I'll get back to you. And hopefully, I can get my Messenger back up and running sometime soon. But if not, then you can always get through to me on the Instagram Messenger there.
Okay, important information there. Absolutely. Okay, well, I'm sorry about that. Hopefully, yeah. This will take your mind off those frustrations we're going to talk about. Yes, in the 80s. And as we very well are aware, there's a whole book about Yes in the 80s by Stephen Lamb, who came on and spoke to us about it, and Dave Watkinson as well has contributed to this great book about the 80s. And I just wanted to read Dave's little introduction, or part of Dave's little introduction about Yes in the 80s, to set the scene for what we're going to talk about. He says, "The beginning of the decade saw the Drama album arrive from a changed Yes, which was received with a mixture of shock and awe, leaving the classic lineup to the past behind, yet providing a viable future for the band. Then the evolution of the new Yes music of 90125 sent more shockwaves through the fan world again, creating what has become a silly but engaging and ongoing love-hate relationship for the era amongst Yes fans. The 1970s Yes fans were labelled Troopers, after the Yes album track Starship Trooper, and the fans of the 80s Yes style and newbies to the band called themselves Generators, from the Big Generator album. And Yes West and Yes East to the future fandom chats, and you will see why following Yes can be both entertaining and challenging in equal measure." So yes, indeed, the 80s, like so many decades so far for Yes the band, have been traumatic in some ways, particularly for fans. However, let's think about what they actually did in the 80s. Four studio albums: Drama, 90125, Big Generator, and ABWH, if you're happy to have ABWH as part of the Yes output. Are you happy to do that, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think most people consider ABWH, for example, a Yes record. You know, I mean, there's technically only like one person missing from it to be a full-fledged Yes album. So I think that would be fine with considering that. I mean, obviously Drama is technically a Yes album anyways, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think I agree with you about ABWH, and certainly Yes Official. If you go onto the Yes Official website, yesworld.com, you'll see that ABWH has been taken into the Yes camp, or the Yes, I don't know what you call it, universe now.
So they certainly think of it as a Yes album, so perhaps we ought to do the same. So I was thinking about the different decades. So going right back to the beginning, in the 60s, there was one album from Yes, but of course they only started in 1968, so that's highly surprising. In the 70s were 8, which is really a surprising number. they certainly were prolific, especially in the early 70s. The 80s, there were 4, if you count ABWH, just 4. So that's half the number of albums in the 70s. In the 90s, 6 or 5, depending on whether you count Keys to Ascension just once or twice. Mm-hmm. I think I would count that as 6. And between 2000 and 2023, so in those 2+ decades, there have only been 5 or 6, if you want to count, as I do, From a Page as a Yes album, complete as well. So it's certainly not that they've been extremely prolific in any of those decades. There are some bands who have, certainly in the 70s and 80s perhaps, have done the album a year and tour a year, but that must be incredibly rare, I suppose. But 8 in the 70s, only 4 in the 80s, and really 3 if you're not happy with ABWH. It's quite a difference, isn't it?
Yeah, that definitely is. I mean, but you think about it, there are reasons for it. I mean, the 70s, for example, it was more known to, you know, do an album like more frequently. I mean, there were many bands that did sometimes 2 albums a year.
Yeah.
I mean, I can think of like Rush did 2 albums a year a couple of times. Kiss did it a couple of times. I mean, I know the Who did a couple of albums, like 2 albums a year in spots. So, and then, you know, these tours, bands would do these tours. But, you know, the big difference with the 80s is that while a band would do an album and then tour, if you did an album in the 80s and the album went really big, because don't forget, some of these numbers that they sold in the 80s were gigantic compared to the 70s.
Yes.
Right. So the tours would be also 2-3 times longer. That's why you wouldn't have an album and a tour every year, because they'd be touring for 2 years almost for some of these albums, you know?
Yeah. Certainly 90125 tour was absolutely vast, wasn't it? And then they had the problem in the 80s with the production of Big Generator, the follow-up to that incredibly successful album, certainly in the US, 90125. But they found it very, very difficult to follow that up with Big Generator for a variety of different reasons that we've gone into at length in our time. But what did you think of ABWH when that came along? So it just snuck into the end of the 80s, 89, I think it was released in. And did you think that was a very promising direction?
When the record first came out, I mean, the first thing that you see, of course, when you go into the record store, you see that cover. And you're like, ooh, okay. This looks promising. And then you see the names, you know, Anderson, Bruford, and you're like, wait a minute, this is Yes. You know, like this is pretty much Yes. So, you know, you go and grab it and, you know, bring it home. And it has a lot of Yes, you know, parts to it. And the musically, it sounds that way. As soon as John starts singing, you feel a very familiar sense to it. But of course, you know, and we discussed this in great detail as well, but as soon as the drums come in, you're like, whoa, wait a minute. What the heck is going on here now? Because I remember that us Rush fans went through a similar shock in 1984 when Grace Under Pressure came out and we heard Neil Peart using Simmons drums on a few songs there. And we're like, ugh, what is that? You know? Because come on, who likes those zoom, 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 those drums? Like, they sound ridiculous, yeah? So, yeah. I besides that, the album is really good. You know, I've always enjoyed it. And like I said, I've always kind of considered it a Yes album as well. So I have good thoughts of it. I've always just said, though, if they could somehow, with this AI technology that we have now, replace the Simmons drums with real drums, I wonder what that would sound like.
Well, maybe someone out there is already doing that. So let us know if you are. That'd be fascinating to hear it. And it does strike me that I've got the 4 albums that we're talking about here. That the 80s version of Yes that you think of, I mean, the first thing you think isn't of Drama or ABWH, is it? It's of 90125 and Big Generator. And that's only 2 albums. Only 2 albums with that lineup. Now, of course, that lineup were to reform after Union and produce Talk But for the 80s themselves, it's quite remarkable to have such a definition of the 80s version of Yes, including Trevor Rabin and Tony Kaye and the rest, just from two albums.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it is a fascinating point that you bring up there. Like, when you say to somebody, 80s Yes, they don't think of Drama. They don't think of that. They immediately think 90125. It's the first thing that most people say. I mean, some people think Big Generator, and most people think that one. Because, let's face it, the Owner of a Lonely Heart was all over the radio. It was all over MTV, that video. I mean, this was a huge return. You know, Atlantic Records were very happy that the, you know, Yes, that had been kind of quiet for a few years, were back up and running. And they were even more happier when that single did so well for them that they pushed it like crazy. And again, that tour was a huge success. I mean, suddenly no longer was it, you know, tour buses and stuff anymore. It was now planes again, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So it's certainly nothing like that for Drama. It was kind of the end of an era there, and going out with the Buggles, those two brand new people to most of the concert going public, I suppose, a great surprise to see Jeff Downes and Trevor Horn there. But certainly Drama was produced and released in the 80s. So we've got to include it. So what we've done is we've both come up with three or four, well, let's say one per album, shall we, and go through it in chronological order, come up with one song that we think, well, I mean, it may be our favourite, it may be what we think is the best, but anyway, we've chosen one song from each of these albums, and I'm going to start off with Drama. And, you know, you might find some of my selections slightly controversial, but, you know, that's why we do this.
Controversial? No.
No, perhaps not. Perhaps not. Anyway, for Drama, I've gone for Tempus Fugit, or Tempus Fugit, however you want to pronounce it. And one of the reasons I like this is because it feels to me like a great full band composition. Everybody appears to be really pulling in the same direction. And I think that's probably true for the whole of this album, actually. Mm-hmm. So you've got things like the fantastic soaring guitar, how guitar over the top, and an amazing bass line on Tempus Fugit from Chris Squire. But also, and I particularly enjoyed watching the official video for this, and you can see what all the guys are doing there. I'm particularly impressed with what Jeff Downes is doing in this song. And of course, it wouldn't be the same without the rock that is Alan White, as we talked about last week. Now, they've got some effects and some hooks in there which have a bit of an 80s feel to them. Some of the keyboards do, but I think they are very well integrated into the song. And Jeff Downes uses that, what is it called, a talk box or something like that, to do the vocoder or whatever it is. To do that yes sort of refrain, which I think works extremely well. And some other things I like about it are the horn and Squire vocal harmonies, which I think are great. But the best thing about it, I suppose, is the energy and the fast and furious playing, and a real harder edged Yes. And when you listen to some of those abortive Paris session songs, which were very much softer, quieter, more, I don't know, flower powery than this sort of thing, then it really took a different turn. So that's my choice from Drama, Tempus Fugit. So what have you gone for?
Well, for me, I picked one song because, but I think that represents Drama well to me. And I think for Yes fans, when they kind of, you know, discovered that, you know, there was change about, I think that when they heard this song, they felt sort of that, you know, everything was kind of okay still, even though there was change. It's not, nothing went, you know, too crazy, because when you have a song like Machine Messiah on the album, you know, a 10-minute long song, it has all the kind of pieces that you want in a Yes song, some great guitar playing, some fantastic bass and drum from Alan White and Chris Squire. I mean, those two guys are really the stars of that album. I think that rhythm section of this album is one of the most, you know, rock solid. And I mean, you have to put Steve Howe in there as well. I mean, those three were rehearsing quite a bit during that time of that record. alone, yeah. Just those three, until they figured out what was going on. So their connection is strong on that album. And I think the vocals are fantastic on there. The acoustic guitar playing is really well done in the verses. And I definitely think that Jeff Downs should get a lot more credit as a keyboard player on this album. And in this song, there's some fantastic keyboard work on here, a lot of good Moog stuff. And another thing that doesn't get brought up a lot is that Jeff Downs kind of brought Yes into the future a bit more, because a lot of his keyboards were more up to date. Let's just put it this way. I mean, Rick Wakeman's known to be using, like, you know, the Hammonds and the Moogs and the Mellotrons. And these are all great keyboards and keyboards that are associated very much with the 60s and 70s. But, you know, Jeff started using things like Oberheims and PPGs, and he's using, like all kinds of things, like ARPs and all kinds of newer equipment, like these vocoders and stuff like that. I think even Trevor Horn brought that up in the documentary, that he thought that the big advantage of bringing Jeff in was that he was more up to date with the keyboard sounds and made Yes more current because of that.
Yes, absolutely. And I did notice that very much listening to Tempus Fugit as well, is the much bigger range. Perhaps not playing all the keyboards in those videos, those really nice videos that they do. Certainly the range is greater. And wasn't Jeff, in fact, credited with being the first person to play a Fairlight synthesizer live? So, you know, he was very much at the cutting edge, and he still is very much at the cutting edge of keyboard technology. So I think it was a fantastic transition album, I suppose you could call it that. But had they managed to stay together, goodness knows what they may have come up with. But of course they didn't, which brings us on to 90125 and fascinating comments from Trevor Rabin himself when we talked to him for our 600th episode. He had no intention of, and of course he didn't, of joining Yes. Yes was kind of put together around him and around a lot of his songs. If you listen to 90124, his demos, it's fascinating to hear how those songs were put together and constructed into this great album, 90125. So my choice from 90125 is Changes. And there are other songs on here that I absolutely love. I love Hold On and Cinema, the sort of live song, the only vestige of the band called Cinema. And City of Love, I think, is a beautiful song. And Hearts, I think, is also a very beautiful song. But Changes I went for. And I've told this story before, but I love the marimba, or whatever it is, tuned percussion at the beginning, and that very strange time signature and pattern. And my drum teacher, this is the thing I've told several times, but my drum teacher wrote it out for me so that I could learn to play the Alan White beat at the beginning there, which I absolutely loved. And, you know, this felt progressive. This felt like it was heading back towards Yes's prime, well, if you want to call it that, the 70s version of Yes in their prime, because it was a bit different and certainly didn't sound anything like any other pop music of the time that I was listening to. And of course, this was along with Tomato, this was my first glimpse of Yes in any iteration. So that was fascinating. And of course, the Trevor Horn, fantastic production, amazing the way the drums come in, and just everything about these songs on 90125 seems to be just perfectly judged to me. But it also had that screeching Rabin guitar in there, and there's piano in there, and it ramps back up to the pattern again. And also I liked the swapping of lead vocals between Rabin and Anderson. I thought that worked extremely well on Changes. Lots of chorus, and there was lots of guitar in the chorus and an unusual guitar solo thrown in there. And also really well paced, I think this song is. There's that section, one word from you, one word from me, which is a little sort of hiatus moment. And it's a great piece of song construction, I think, because then we go right back to the triumphant chorus and finally back to the marimba to close that out. So I think it's a really well put together song. We're, you know, brimming with interesting and exciting elements. And yeah, one of my favorites from the album.
Yeah, that's a fantastic pick. And just a little sort of side note. I don't know if you guys have this chocolate bar in the UK, but we have this chocolate bar here called Kit Kat.
Yes, we have that.
And over here, I distinctly remember this. There was this commercial, 30-second one. It was like, give yourself a break. Get a Kit Kat. And yeah. The music under it was dun 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 dun.
Really?
Dun, dun, dun.
No, and I didn't realize that.
And I remember hearing that, like, wait a minute, where did I hear that before? Like, it was because it was like back in the day, this commercial. Okay. Yeah. And I thought to myself, did Yes really allow them to use that? Or was this a blatant robbery of that part right. used in there? Because it sounds exactly like it, but I don't remember Yes ever, like reading the ever that they've allowed for a chocolate commercial with their song. So who knows? Right.
Well, I bet someone knows. Let us know. Kit Kat using Yes music in the 80s. Let us know.
Yes. So my pick, and again, you would think that with an album like this, that it would be simple to pick a song. But as you pointed out, that this album is like just a clear winner top to bottom. There's no skippable songs on here whatsoever. I mean, everything in here is fantastic. But I went for what might seem like an obvious choice, but I picked Owner of a Lonely Heart. Really? I mean, Owner of a Lonely Heart is a song that I feel is absolutely essential in the existence of Yes. It is absolutely vital in the existence of this band. Without this song, there would be no Yes. I know a lot of people argue about that. Oh, they would have got back together eventually. And blah. But no, not in the way that we know them now, because this got them back on the charts, which is something that they hadn't done in years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It got them on the charts. It got them on MTV. You know, suddenly Yes, who were looked at as rock dinosaurs, are now suddenly hip and cool again and on MTV again. So this was an extremely important thing. And Trevor Rabin, being the younger guy in the band, you know, they were focused on, if you notice in the video, like the performance one of that, of Owner of Only the Heart, they zoom in him on him a lot. You know, he's the kind of, you know, smiley, good looking guy. So they always look at him. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, the song was very important, I think, in getting Yes to where they needed to be in the 80s to keep them in existence and going forward. I mean, there's always, when a band has lasted this long, no doubt you can go back into their catalog and you can find, oh, that's the album that did it. This is the album that solidified their position and where they didn't have to worry about the record companies going, well, you know, guys, if we don't come up with another good album, you're out of here, you know? Yes. So I think that really helped them out with that.
Yeah.
And so I think Owner of a Lonely Heart is definitely the song that I would pick.
Brilliant. Yes. And it's one of those that it's difficult to think about and listen to, I suppose, because it's so omnipresent, isn't it? It's everyone, it's a lot of people's definition of Yes, if they are more focused on the 80s than the 70s, of course, and because it's the most obvious one. However, Big Generator. Now, we always get some good comments when we talk about Big Generator, because you and I actually are rather keen on Big Generator, I seem to remember, from our different conversations we've had over the years. But I can see why people were disappointed. Maybe that's the right word. Certainly it took an awfully long time to come out because of the very difficult genesis of the record, the way that Trevor Horn started and then left, and different recording locations around the world, including a sort of palace in Italy, wasn't there, before going back to the US and being put together and finished off there. So, and a lot of problems with getting the material together as well, I think. But, and we usually talk about Talk as one of Trevor Rabin's great achievements with the band, but I think Big Generator is as well, because if Trevor Rabin hadn't been there and hadn't been such a proficient and professional and great producer, I don't think we would have had this record at all. And what I think he's done with it is really, really good. And a number of these songs are longer and, again, put together in a really fascinating way, which points back more towards the Yes of earlier years.
Mm-hmm.
And I may have chosen the same one as you, and I know that Trevor Rabin himself loves this song, Shoot High, Aim Low. And for me, you know, there are so many different aspects to this song. There's an atmospheric beginning, and Trevor Rabin, if it was him, I assume it was, put in some of those orchestral sounds, and it's really atmospheric and tantalizing. What on earth's going to happen in this song? But what one of the aspects that really surprises me about it is that it's so held back, and that's the expression that I kept thinking to myself as I was listening to it to prepare for this. It's so laid back, it's so held back, but yet there's still so much to enjoy and so much going on through it. But you know, even the drumming. Listen to the drumming, and again, it reminded me of what Joe Cass said to us about Alan's drumming, the way it was held back and it lets it breathe. But this song, Shoot High, Aim Low, is 6 minutes and 59 seconds, so it's a 7 minute song essentially, and it has the same tempo throughout. But then again, there's so much contrast and so much fascinating stuff in there. Again, I like the Anderson and Rabin duet. I think their voices work really well together, and it has a huge sing-along chorus, of course, and yes. It sounds like there's got bass pedals in there shaking the foundations, and it proves in a way that you don't need speed to be exciting, because I do find it a very exciting piece of music. And other aspects of it, you've got that amazing acoustic guitar solo from Rabin, one of his real trademarks, and particularly live he did some amazing of those acoustic guitar solos in there. And it has such an expansive feel, but also has a great electric solo, guitar solo in there as well. And I suppose you could imagine that it's quite simple because of that's the pulse, which remains the same throughout. But in fact, listening to it carefully, there's an awful lot going on in there. So that's a real high point for me, Shoot High, Aim Low.
Yeah, that's a great song. I mean, it has such an ambiance and a mood to it. It's really well done. And like you said, it doesn't need to be fast to be exciting. I mean, that whole, even the introduction where it kind of fades in with those little tom fills that Alan does, and then those weird keyboard sounds in the background, it sets up nicely for what was to come in the song. And it's great. The lyrics are good. Everything about it is fantastic. And it's definitely a high point on the album. And I think, again, it's one of those things where 70s Yes fans might go, oh, you know, there's something here for me to like still, when it comes to that. But for me, the song that I picked is one that I think won't be a surprise. Love Will Find a Way. Yeah. I think that Love Will Find a Way is one of these examples of Trevor Rabin, again, expanding the horizon a bit as far as the guitar playing. I mean, he uses a 12-string electric on this song,
right.
Which, you know, people will say, well, it's Steve Howe used it on Awaken, which is true, but you know, this is such a, but it's so dominant on this song, this guitar. It's just fantastic, and it's such a centerpiece of this song. And again, we have some great harmonized vocals on there with John, Chris, and with Trevor. And Trevor's more the center vocal on this song. But it's again an important song for the reason that if they would have not had a song like this on the record, I don't think there would have been as much eyes on it, because again, there was a video for this song and they were on MTV again because of this song, right? I mean, people always kind of roll their eyes when you talk about, you know, radio play and this and that, but you got to remember in the 80s, this was all important at the time, you know? Yes. This is, if you're not on the radio, if you're not on MTV, you ain't doing nothing, you know?
Yeah.
And you're not being looked at, and you're not taken seriously, you know? So I think that while, you know, there's other songs on here, like Big Generator is a good song. Rhythm of Love was also one that had a video that was a pretty strong song as well.
Yep.
But without those songs in there, you know, I don't think that it would have did as well, because think about it. They got huge on 90125 again, which was a commercially successful record. If they came back with a completely progressive-only record that went 180 from 90125, then the people would have scratched their heads and probably just gave up on it again, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do like Love Will Find a Way, and I had the 12-inch version of that, which I played a lot. It was very, very enjoyable. And, of course, that was all part of the 80s, as we, if you remember our singles sequence that we did, and we looked at all the singles over the years, and the 80s were the era of Trevor Horn, who I suppose championed the extended remix in the 80s, and that was great fun. But yes, one of my favourite Yes records, I suppose, that 12-inch of Love Will Find a Way. Great stuff. Okay, well, we're on to the final album of the 80s, which we are happy to call a Yes album, ABWH, Anderson Bruford, Wakeman Howe. And once again, we've said a lot about this over the years, and there are aspects of it, like the drums, as we've already said, which are difficult to take at sometimes. And in certainly live, I think they didn't work particularly well. But you may have your own opinions on that, of course. Now, perhaps this is the... Yeah. See, I could have gone for Tique Bois and then really alienated people. but no, I didn't. And I find... Yeah, see, I have a funny relationship with some of these songs, actually, because I find Brother of Mine a little bit sort of cheesy at times. And I rather like The Meeting and Birthright. But I actually went for Fist of Fire, which is not a song which I've heard a lot of people talking about very much. And funnily enough, I've always really liked the title. Fist of Fire seems in some ways quite an un-Yes-like idea. But I thought Fist of Fire, that sounds really fascinating and intriguing. And I think the synthesized percussion works rather well on this for me. It could have been horrendous, but actually I think it works. Even the gong at the beginning. And it's obviously a synthesized gong, but I still think it fits in okay. And again, there's a lot more going on here than it at first appears. I'm sure there are many people who absolutely hate the Wakeman chords. They're so in your face, but I actually quite like it. And he has these massive strident chords in there, but I find them really effective. And also then his synth soloing over the top of that as well. I mean, it's like a razor blade cutting at you, this sound he uses. But again, I find it really, really good fun, and I think it works rather well in this song. For Steve Howe's part, he's comparatively low in the mix, but I think his soloing provides a good contrast here as well. I do think he's not very apparent in this song, actually, Steve Howe, and maybe across the whole album he has less profile than perhaps he could have done. But yeah. I love the energy, and there's an almost sort of violent intensity to it, I thought, as I was listening to it again. And Anderson's singing, very powerful. There's a strong and constant beat through Fist of Fire. And, you know, that part where he sings, "Through the darkest days, we can surely fly through the darkest age with a fist of fire." And in the end, I think it's a positive song, but in a very, very different way to a lot of other Yes music. So what do you think, Fist of Fire?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely wouldn't have been the song that I thought that you would pick from this album. But, you know, I think for all the little... points that you pointed out about the song, you know, the abrasive chords and the soloing and stuff like that. The one thing that it has an advantage about itself when it comes to that is that it's only 3 minutes and 27 seconds long. Yeah, so it's not like you have like 11 minutes of this, you know, where you'd be pulling your hair out by 8 minutes.
Yeah, it wouldn't work, no.
Yeah, so, but I mean, it works, I think, well on this record, because this album is... pretty long. It has a lot of longer pieces on here, so having a piece like that on there, I think, is beneficial. And it's at the beginning of the album too, you know. I think that, you know, if they wanted to, you know, put a piece like that on there, I think it's best to put it at the beginning of the record and, you know, see how it works. And maybe that's the place that they felt it worked the best, because they have a short one at the beginning and they have a short one right at the end as well, Let's Pretend, right? So I think that works well. I mean, I like this album. There's nothing about this album that I don't like. I mean, I have to agree with you about Brother of Mine being a little cheesy. I mean, especially the ending. The ending of it is a little sing-a-line. Long lost brother of mine. Everybody clap your hands, you know.
Like, well, that's the Jeff Downes bit, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a little tacky, that part, you know. But, you know, there's a... The album itself kind of rides that line, I find, where it's really... well done, really cool, really good ideas in there. I think John Anderson really wanted to put his Yes ideas back into an album, because I think he was fed up by the end of Big Generator with how that was going. And this is, you know, more a 180 turn from Big Generator. There's longer songs on here, a lot of, you know, multiple sections of songs, you know. So, but yes. The song that I picked on here, because again, you could have picked almost anything from on here. I picked Order of the Universe. That song yeah. I've always kind of liked. Again, you can always say too that, well, that has a cheesy part too with the Order of the Universe.
Like that's like all, that.
but it fits. You know, I think it works well in there. And I think that it's one of those songs I also enjoyed when you watch those excellent live videos of them playing on the ABWH tour. They play this, and there's also a great footage of them doing rehearsals for this tour, and they also play this as well during the rehearsal. And I really like this song. I think that Bill Bruford has some interesting percussion stuff in here.
Yes.
The whole beginning is rather interesting how they do it. The main thing about this album is that it's centered around John. It's centered around his ideas. And when you do that, you're bound to get a sort of strong Yes album in there.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that you bring up the fact about Steve Howe maybe not being as center stage as he is on other Yes albums. But again, this is something that I think he has maybe a little bit of himself to blame for this, because what do we know about Steve that he likes to do? And it's present on this album and a lot of other albums. These guys go to the Caribbean islands.
Yes,
right. I forget. I think it's Montserrat they went to.
Yes, yes.
To work on this album. And Steve Howe's nowhere to be seen. It's just Bill Bruford, Rick Wakeman, and John there. And then the other, you know, assisting musicians that they have.
Yes.
Right? No Steve. He does everything back home in London, records everything on his own by himself, you know, for whatever reasons that is. But then, you know what? When you don't get involved in it, then that kind of stuff happens, because then people get his tracks and they go, what in the Lord is he playing here? Why is he playing this here? This is not what we thought to do. And then they take it out.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So if he would have been there with them in Montserrat doing it, I have a feeling he would have been a lot more in the mix and in the music. You know, it's not that he's not in there, but, you know, he would have been more present, I think.
Yes. Yes. And I think that did lead to quite a bit of Wakeman, you know, because it's like on Tomato, where they were both occupying the same sonic space.
Yes.
They, you know, that you could say that that's also happening on albums like Emerson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe. But yes, I agree with you. Order of the Universe, great, great song. And again, it's one of those sort of sweet ones, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I always get very annoyed with whoever put the packaging together for the original version of Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe, because it's got dark red on black, and
yes.
it's incredibly difficult to see. So Order of the Universe, yes, you've got the Order theme, and then Rock Gives Courage. I hardly read it. It's So Hard to Grow, and the Universe, yeah. And I think that works really, really well, and I think it's a very strong part of the album. I think it's a very strong album, and I don't get as annoyed as a lot of people do by the drums on the album itself, which I certainly do live. I don't think they worked particularly well. However, there we go. There's 1980 to 1989. We've got through the whole lot, and our choices will certainly not be your choices. So please do add your choices into the show notes for this week's episode on yesmusicpodcast.com. But for the moment, maybe we'll come back and do a 90s one, particularly when there's a rumoured book about Yes in the 90s.
Yes.
So maybe before that, or maybe to coincide with that, we can do Yes in the 90s. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is... these go to 11.
Just before we go, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Joseph Cottrell, Ken Fuller and Jeffrey Griselius. And half the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Jim Morrison, John Pickles, Declan Logg, Gary Betts, Alan Begg, Michael Handahan, Barry Gorski, Steve Perry, Doug Curran, Martin Kelberg, Todd Dudley, Rachel Hadaway, Lind, Paul Hales, Craig Estenes, Mark James Lang, Steve Rode, David, Bob Martellotta, John Holden, Stephen Lamb, Dem, Fred Barringer, Scott Colombo, Chris Bandini, David Hayden, and John Thompson. As always, thank you very much indeed to all those patrons and producers. If you'd like to help them keep the lights on here at Yes Music Podcast Towers, then please do head over to patreon.com, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. As I always say, that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We do hope to be back next week. And in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via x.com, Facebook, or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.